My castaway this week is a playwright. Brought up in a poor family, he couldn't talk until he was 8 or 9. He left school at 16, became a teacher in his late 20s, and then started writing for a living. For 7 years, he wrote scripts for Brookside. 3 years ago, he was asked to write for a new television series about a criminal psychologist. It was called Cracker, and it's turned out to be the television drama of the 1990s, so much so that its author has been able to wheel out all his rejected work on the back of it, proving with films like Priest and Hearts and Minds that he was always a great talent waiting for the moment of discovery. He is Jimmy McGovern. Let's start with Cracker, Jimmy, a television detective for the 1990s, as I say. How much was Fitz your creation and how much that of the producer?
It was an awful lot of me and him, you know. At my worst, I was Fitz. At his worst, at his best, he was the kind of person I aspired to be.
So at his worst, he's what, a gambler and a boozer?
Yeah, and a smoker.
And yeah. At his best, well, I mean, what do you aspire to be?
At his best, he's a man in pursuit of a pure motive. He's a fine man at his best, a caring, compassionate man. But I'm very rarely that.
Yeah. He's also a witty man, is that you?
No, it takes me an awful long time to think of them. I envy people like Fitz. I envy Robbie Coltrane. There was one night when it was at a Cracker rap party and he had us all in stitches. He was absolutely brilliant. And then at the end of the night, he played the piano brilliantly too, and I hated him. You know, and I can never be like that. All those witticisms take me hours and hours and hours to dream up.
So none of it is Robbie Coltrane. He doesn't bring the wit to the script. The script is yours entirely.
It's nearly always on the off the page. All the wisecracks are off the page. But occasionally he throws in a few of his own. He threw in a beauty about garden gnomes once, which I've told everybody it was mine.
But he was the one thing that wasn't your creation or your thought. Mm. Presumably, when you were told, because you wanted this man with sex appeal and all the rest of it, when you were told you were getting a kind of fairly hefty, funny man to play this role, you must have thought they were mad.
I was suicidal. I thought it was the biggest mistake ever made. Because I had this guy, this thin, wiry guy in mind. And
like you, really?
Well, I used to be thinner and more wiry than this. And then they said Robbie Coltrane. I was just amazed. I was going to walk. I was on the phone to my agent. And then the first few rushes came out. And he was absolutely astounding. And he lost weight for the part early on. He lost a bit of weight. He looked sharp. He was sharp. His brain is so quick, you know.
And so
he's perfect.
But why do you think it works as a piece? It's interesting, isn't it?
I think part of the reason is the why. You know, people are so fascinated about why people, you know. I mean, for years there'd been Inspector Morse and a kind of intellectual pursuit of the criminal. And now, to have a guy who investigates why. Because I was always a fan of the human jungle, Herbert Lom. But Herbert Lom used to just say, this is wrong with you, you set fire to the hamsters at school. And end the programme. There was no in-depth probing with Herbert Lom.
But this is all about the confession, isn't it? I mean, that's what you're not building up to the big arrest, you're building up to the big confession.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's pure drama, isn't it? Because you can go on and on for hours with those interrogations, and we often did.
The other big why is, why Cracker? Why is it called Cracker?
It was only ever a working title, and I can remember cold sweats, because I thought, you know, we're a hostage to fortune here. Cracker, damp squib. I saw all the headlines, you know. And it was a working title that just stuck.
But why Cracker? What does it mean?
Yeah, Ask Up Neil was his title. He said something about cracker can mean crackpot, it can mean firecracker, it can mean cracker like some kind of Chinese puzzle. I'm not sure. But
anyway, it worked.
Yeah, yeah.
Enough of Fitz. Let's learn more about McGovern. Tell me about your first record.
I picked this for my mam, and it's just a song my mam used to sing going around about the house. You know, this little two up, two down, with loads of kids and not very much money at all. And this woman singing When I Fall in Love, it stayed with me ever since.
When I fall in love, it will be forever, or I'll never fall in love.
Nat King Cole and When I Fall in Love. It must have been a very rewarding experience when you became hot property, as it were, in the television script writing world. It was 1993, wasn't it? And the phone started to ring. Was it as a direct result of Cracker?
I think it probably was, yeah. I'd worked really hard, you know, and I'd been working hard on Hearts and Minds, and particularly Priest, which was always my ambition, Priest, you know. But I was just a writer, same as everybody else, you know.
But Cracker hadn't come out on the screen, had it? It was just kind of known in the business that they were after
out.
You.
Yeah, word got out that it was good. And I thought to myself, this is a winner because all the men in suits materialised. Success has many fathers, failure's always an orphan. And when the men in suits came around, I thought, this is a winner.
So who rang up first? So this was ITV that was considering Cracker and word got out that you were hot. So who rang up first?
I think it was the BBC for Priest, and then it was Channel 4 for Hearts and Minds. But in fairness to Channel 4, I'd been working on Hearts and Minds a long, long time.
But it had all been going a bit slowly.
It had been going very slowly.
So these were scripts that they'd tucked away in their drawers, as it were?
Well, they were sort of work in progresses, you know. All my scripts are working. I've got this stamp which says work in progress. I dare not call anything a draft. And it was all work in progress in a way, and... You know, maybe it would have got made if I hadn't done Cracker, but Cracker, at the very least, it concentrated people's minds.
But does that kind of experience make you feel sort of angry, or are you just resigned to the fact that, you know, one day nobody much wants to know and you're just left in the drawer and the next minute everybody wants to know? What does that make you feel?
I'm quite blasé about it now, you know. It happened to me at the right time, but I'd hate to have gone through this when I was 35. Also, a further thought is you spend all your life and you write all your best stuff trying to get to a position whereby you can write what you want to write. But once you reach that position, you've already written it, and you haven't got any more ideas, and your energy level's down. I've seen that happen time and time again with writers.
Is that where you are?
Crackhead took an awful lot out of me. Hearts and Minds and Priest took even more out of me. And I'm sort of conserving my energy now. I haven't got the same amount of energy as I had on the way up, you know, and now I'm nearly... I'm nowhere near the top, but I'm sort of... three quarters of the way up that ladder now. But I'm feeling a bit tired. It's been hard going.
And it's all happened in such a short period, really, in a sense, although you've been trying to get there for a long time.
Yeah.
And the things that you've just mentioned, you know, the big pieces, you've actually put together in the last, 5 years?
Right, yeah. Really, really, really quick. But I had loads of energy, and you've been banging on the door, and then all of a sudden it's open, and my God, you go through it, you know, and the energy level is high.
But what advice do you give to a struggling writer who's banging on that door and who may well have, you know, equally good material, maybe an equally great talent, but they're not letting them through?
Well, I don't know. You just got to stick at it. Do your 100 episodes of EastEnders or Brookside. Who knows, you know, the door might open, but you've got to be lucky, you know, and in the right place at the right time.
Record number 2.
The reason I picked this is because I can remember the very first record player, my father bringing it into the house, one of those red plastic things. And we didn't have a record. We now had a record player, but we didn't have a record. Now, my mum used to spend an awful lot of time in the pawn shop because it was a pawn shop economy. And she used to talk at the street for the pawn shop. So we sent next door and asked them for a loan of a record. And the record they sent was this one. And my mum went berserk.
She'll tell you somewhere there's a rich millionaire who is calling again about 8.
There's a pawn shop on a corner in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania,
and I've just gotta get 5 or 10.
5 or 10 from the pawn shop on a corner in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Gotta be with my angel.
Guy Mitchell and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So you were born, Jimmy McGovern, just after the war in Liverpool, Catholic working class family, 5th of 9 children, pawn shop on the corner. You knew a lot about being poor. How poor? What was it like?
We were quite poor, you know. We had a father who worked really, really hard, so he earned his poverty. We were well fed, well cared for, but we were poor. It was okay to be poor then in the primary school, but as soon as I passed the 11 plus, I mixed with kids who weren't poor. And that's the only time I became aware of the fact that we were poor.
The kids made you aware of that?
Other kids who, you know, because in the old street, everybody was poor. You know, there were kids running around with no shoes on their feet. But once I went to school with kids who were quite rich, I mean, not rich, but fathers with doctors and that kind of thing, that opened my eyes.
Well, they made fun of you because your clothes were
holy. No, the kids were normally okay. It was the staff. I think the staff couldn't handle poor kids. All those problems that are there, you know, low self-esteem. I used to crack a lot of jokes and misbehave in class. And it wasn't because I was poor, but, you know, there were all kinds of other reasons as well. You know, I had a stammer as well. I found an awful lot of the staff just couldn't handle it.
Tell me about the stammer, because you literally didn't speak properly until you were eight or nine, did you?
I know. I had to have this interpreter who was my elder brother, Joey. And I remember coming home once from school, primary school, going, and all my mum heard was doctor. So she sent for Joey, panic. He's saying something about the doctor, and Joey had to come, you know, from school and hear me out and translate. And I was saying, the doctor said I was as strong as an ape, you know. But my mum just panicked. But I had to have an interpreter. I don't know why. I was quite bright. It wasn't anything like that, you know.
But was there a moment when suddenly the words burst through and you were able to speak?
No, there wasn't. I've always had problems with my speech.
But you became intelligible at some point.
Oh yeah, around about, I'm not sure how old I was when I became intelligible. But, I, as far as I was concerned, I was always intelligible. It was their fault. Everything I said made perfect sense. But,
it's a character, actually, the stutterer, that turns up a lot in your plays. I think the first murderer in The First Cracker had a stammer. He was very articulate when he was angry. Is that
true? That wasn't the very first cracker, no. That was a guy called Sean in the three-parter. He had a stammer. He got very violent when he couldn't communicate.
And he also hit his side to try and force the words out.
Yeah, I used to do that.
Is that what you did?
Yeah, I used to do that, yeah. The worst thing of all in school was having to say 9 o'clock Mass and Holy Communion every Monday morning. And to get the n out, the nine out, I'd bang my side. And then, of course, in the playground, the kids would follow, would walk after me, banging the side and contorting their faces. And I found it contagious, like lots of kids started to stammer. It was just like I was spreading this germ, you know. I hated it then, but now I'm quite proud of it. You know, it's part of me, and it's helped. You know, I quite like the man I am now, with all my faults.
And when do you stammer now? Because you're not stammering at the moment.
Yeah, but I'm being very careful now in talking to you, because I'm constantly switching words, you know. I mean, that's the worst thing to do, really, switch words. You know, I haven't come out yet as a stammerer. I'm always constantly switching words.
Well, use a word that you know you can get out, as opposed to one that might get stuck.
Yeah.
And then when you began to write, I mean, what was writing? Well, is there a link, perhaps, between the stammer and the writing, that in fact when you wrote you were fluent?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I could pick the apt word, you know, because I'm a word switcher, even as a child. I had loads of words at my disposal. My vocabulary was wide because I was constantly, you know, pick this word, pick that word, use that word. But when I came to write, I could pick the most just, that's the word, the apt word, you know. And the worst thing that ever happened to me, of course, is one day the school teacher asked me to read out my essay, which had all the words in that were just right, but which I could never say.
Tell me about your next record.
I haven't picked this for the fact that I used to stand on the cop, which I did do. You know, it's just meant a lot to me all my life, this song. And it was played at my father's funeral. It's You'll Never Walk Alone.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark.
Jerry and the Pacemakers, and You'll Never Walk Alone. Tell me about this Jesuit grammar school you went to, Jimmy, because it sounds, well, I don't know, reactionary, vindictive, downright cruel, actually. I mean, you were beaten for a start, weren't you?
Yeah, with a whalebone bound in leather, you know, and there's this set ritual. You used to get a card with the number on it, say 4 or 6, and you had to go all morning, and then at break you'd go up to this office and hold your hand out, get the card signed, 4 or 6, hold your hand out and get whacked. And there'd be all kinds of little kids outside the office laughing, wetting themselves that somebody was having pain inflicted upon them.
But what had been your crime? What kind of thing?
If you spoke in class or, you know, you failed to do your homework, you were beaten. These are Jesuit priests. With every single whack, they are teaching these kids to change their ways through cowardice, through fear of pain. And they thought that was wise. It was an absolutely horrendous school.
And
my son went there.
You sent your son there?
He wanted to go, yeah, but it had changed in the meantime. You know, it's now run by Christian Brothers, who aren't quite as vindictive as those Jesuits were.
And they whipped you in the showers as well, apparently.
Well, there was one priest, and he did have problems with the sexuality, repressed homosexuality, and he used to take a football team, and he'd come in and whip us. Priests to us were gods, and people knew what was going on, and nobody said anything.
Why not?
I've no idea. I've no idea. This is the early 60s, you know, and And think the early 60s was still Pope Pius XII. You know, things hadn't changed that much.
And yet your depiction of priests in the film Priest is sympathetic, controversial maybe, but never inherently sympathetic. There's one priest who's having an affair with his housekeeper. There's another who's gay, the main role. And then there's a bishop who swears like a trooper. But basically a charitable, a sympathetic approach to priests. So where did that come from? Why?
It's because every time I've needed priests, they've been there and they've been good priests. Not the priests who taught me. Not those Jesuits, but ordinary priests now. You know, when I came away from that school and I didn't want to know anything about the Catholic faith or the priesthood or priests. But I got to be in my 30s and I changed slightly, you know. And I can remember the church in the aftermath of Hillsborough in 1989. The Catholic Church was wonderful in our city. And on the death of my father, there was a wonderful Catholic priest. At times of grief, they've been there. And at times of joy, I've had the kids christened Catholic. You know, there are one or two individual priests, and that's the best advert for the faith, you know. I mean, I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but a good priest is the finest advert for the Catholic faith ever.
But at the age of 16, you didn't feel like that. And at that age, you turned your back not just on Catholicism, but on education as well. You just left and went, didn't you? You'd had enough.
Yeah.
Record number 4.
At that age, I used to play football on the weekend, and over night time we'd all go out. We were all 15, 16, and we used to have a few pints beforehand, and there was a place called Martin's, and we were all 16, 17-year-old kids, and we all used to dance away. I couldn't dance. And there was a young girl there, and she was the epitome of the 60s. Long blonde hair, eyes of blue, and she terrified us.
Mersey's and Sorrow. Let's jump a few years now in the life of Jimmy McGovern. Go to the mid-70s, by which time you're in your mid-20s, you're married, you've got 3 children, you're living in a council flat, you've been a bus conductor and a porter and you've worked in a car factory and so on, and you've become a gambler. How much did you gamble?
It wasn't an awful lot of cash in a way, because I wasn't earning those kind of wages, you know. I was just a poor man, really, a poor working-class man. But I could lose all my wages.
On a Friday night, just like that?
Yeah, on a Friday afternoon, unfortunately. The worst time of my life was I went over to find out the price of East Germany to draw with Brazil in a World Cup game. And I was only in that betting shop about a quarter of an hour, and I lost a lot. I lost all my wages in a quarter of an hour. It's a weird vice. What you do is you have a bet, it loses. You have a conscience, you know, you've lost this cash that your wife and kids ought to have had. You go chasing that money. And you lose that. You have £5, you have £10, you have £20, and you started off chasing that fiver. You end up chasing 40, 50 quid.
And this, of course, is all in fits, as we've seen. I mean, he in Cracker would stop when he was on his way to do something very important, like deliver a lecture or interview a suspect or something, and suddenly stop and listen to a race on a phone. He had that need to. There's some kind of buzz.
Yeah, I can't quite understand Fitz, though, because I can't see the void in Fitz's life, you know, with the kind of job he does. I think there was a void in my life. I don't mean with the family. They were great. I loved them, you know. But I felt I had things to offer, and boring, mundane jobs weren't the outlet.
But you said before now that gambling fills a kind of creative void.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
I honestly think if you stopped people writing out their bets, you would stop them gambling. It's that notion of changing a piece of paper and a pen into profit and being able to say, I exercised my judgment and I was right. You know, it's creative. It really is creative. But it's far better if you have the kind of job where you can exercise your judgment anyway and get the kudos if you're right. But if you haven't got that kind of job, the answer is have a bet.
So how bad did it get? You were losing all your wages. Did you steal to feed the habit? Some people
No,
did.
There was always a temptation there, though. I understand that. No, I just had a tough wife, and she just put her head down and battled on.
So how did you stop, or perhaps you didn't?
I became a student teacher. I got involved in higher education. That just changed my life.
But do you still have a bet?
Oh, yeah, but that's the funny thing. I can afford to lose the odd few bob now. I'm going to lose a good few bob on Liverpool this season, as a matter of fact. But I don't need to go chasing it. I can write it off to experience.
More music.
When I was a school teacher, I did this wonderful school play about a school, and it was called A Brick in the Wall. At the end of that play, I remember this kid who was a lovely lad marching all down the aisle. It ended in a custard pie fight, and they'd saved one custard pie. And I just saw this kid marching right down the aisle and giving it to me right in the face. You know, but it was a wonderful night. So Pink Floyd, Another Brick in the Wall.
Pink Floyd and Another Brick in the Wall. Let's talk about education then and Hearts and Minds, four-part series which went out in early 95 on Channel 4. That presumably was your experience, really, as a new teacher, going in full of enthusiasm and idealism and becoming desperately disillusioned.
Yeah.
Was it that bad?
It may have been me as well, you know, because lots of school teachers have still got enthusiasm and commitment. You know, I just lost mine in a short space of time. But I thought it was pretty grim at times.
But in the piece, in Hearts and Minds, where you've got teachers attacking pupils, literally, and physically attacking them, parents attacking teachers, certainly verbally, pupils harassing teachers, families. Did all that happen to you?
I was constantly aware of an undercurrent of violence. Yeah, keep it down, keep it down. Once it breaks, it breaks. And I saw a lot of violence, you know.
This was in an inner-city Liverpool school?
Oh, no, this was a school in the leafy suburbs, you know. I mean, it had a fair working-class intake. It had black kids, white kids, Asian kids. It was a good, comprehensive school. The school I taught in was not the same type of school as portrayed in Hearts and Minds. But the same problems were there. Like, here's a school teacher. He's not even trying anymore. But you can't sack him. Here's a staff room where you walk in there and your heart dies, your heart sinks. You know, the lack of energy, the lack of commitment in the staff room.
That seemed to be the message, certainly, of Hearts and Minds, that it was the teachers that were at fault, that they were bored and boring, they were unimaginative, they were lazy, that it wasn't the fault of the kids or the parents, it's the teachers at fault. Is that your view?
That was part of my experience, you know. But I taught some awful kids as well. You know, kids you wanted to throttle. And I've come across some awful parents. But I've got to say, I came across some disgraceful teachers. Born idle. No energy, no commitment. And at the time I taught, I ran football teams. I did the school play. I loved it. And these days, there are lots of comprehensive schools that can't turn out a football team, because the staff are not prepared to give the time. I just find that hard to believe.
But were you as unsuccessful as Drew McKenzie in Hearts and Minds? Did you, in the end, despite all your hard work and your willingness, as you say, to give up your spare time to produce the school play or to run the five-a-side or whatever it is, were you not appreciated like him?
I was by the kids. I taught some smashing kids. No, I think what happened with me is I just got tired. I got by on enthusiasm and commitment, and that's not enough. You've got to have some kind of technique there as well. And also, it coincided with the start of Brookside. Brookside was starting up then. And so all my initial enthusiasm was ebbing away.
Record number 6.
This is the old Brookside tune, because I loved Brookside in those days, and I think it's lost its edge a bit now, it's lost its way a bit now. But the old Brookside and the old Brookside tune, because Brookside means so much to me.
Brookside theme, but the old one, which was when my castaway, Jimmy McGovern, was writing for it. Brookside really gave you this way out. It gave you the leg up you were looking for, really, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
How competitive was it? Because it's a team of writers. I mean, 12 or more, isn't it?
Yeah. It was amazingly competitive in those days. We used to have all these meetings and we'd all get passionate and shout each other down, insult each other. But it was all for the good of the show, in a way.
But would you wait for a call to say you were writing it that week?
It used to happen every fourth Friday afternoon. You'd have your storyline meeting and you'd know the phone would ring the following Friday. And that meant a couple of £1,000, and you wanted that phone to ring. And you'd sit there all day looking at the phone, you know, and then it would ring and it would be some other writer asking if you'd heard anything. Get off the phone, they might be ringing. You know, that's the way you'd go on. And eventually it would dawn on you around about 4:30 or 5:00 that no, you were not going to be chosen this month. It's next month, maybe. You
know? They hadn't bought your ideas.
Yeah.
But when they did, you were writing a lot of scripts for the Grant family, weren't you? The working class Catholic family. So there was a lot of Jimmy McGovern in them, a lot of your anger, your passion, your politics.
Yeah, there was. Yeah.
So what about then, if you put so much of yourself into these scripts, what about the darker side of Fitz? I mean, we said the gambling's yours and the booze and the fags, but he often talks, there's a lot in that script, a kind of relish about man's desire to rape or murder. Where does that come from?
I suspect he's fairly honest, Fitz, and I think he says an awful lot of things that an awful lot of men feel uncomfortable with, but I think he speaks the truth. I think all men are potential rapists. You know, that's a feminist argument, but it's my argument. I think there's a tremendous capacity for evil inside us all.
That's a very depressing view of the world, isn't it? I think, and that's what comes through, I suppose, in Cracker, is that there's little optimism there.
Yeah.
Do you really think the world is such a dark place, or is it just for the purpose of drama?
It is for the purpose of drama, and in Cracker there are huge issues there, you know, an issue like racism and rape in the same programme. That's huge to tackle. But I think I approach that with honesty and integrity, and it's dangerous stuff. But it's not there because I want to shock people.
But that's what the critics have begun to say, isn't it? That there is just a naked desire to shock, that you glorify violence.
Yeah.
People have become, you know, having been initially so in praise of Cracker, have now said that it's descended.
Yeah.
Can you defend that, or do you think perhaps they're right?
The most violent thing I ever saw in my life was 1982, when I was in a pub in Manchester and the Belgrano was sunk and people in the pub cheered and stamped their feet. I said to myself, those people should be on that ship and see what death is like, see these young men drowning. And I think maybe there's an argument for more violence on our screens, as long as we see what real violence is.
How does the one justify the other? I mean, how does putting, you know, pretty raw, naked violence on the screens in things like Cracker justify that?
Because in the first case, it was factual violence. I mean, that violence actually happened. Those young men died. You know, Cracker is fictional. But Cracker, it shows the violence, yes, but it also shows the aftermath of that violence, the effects of that violence, and it shows people grieving. I mean, why couldn't we have seen that when the Belgrano went down, for real? Why couldn't we have seen the grief of their families? I think Cracker's been responsible. I really do. And it's shown violence, yes. It's shown the aftermath of violence. It's shown the pain of people. And it's shown the grief of people who love those people who are dead.
Record number 7.
I've picked this because it reminds me of the time I started work after Brookside for the BBC. And I can remember a screening of Needle, which was a film of mine, up in Edinburgh. And we all went out afterwards for quite a few drinks. And I can remember George Faber, who's now in charge of single drama at the BBC, but at the time he was executive producer of Needle, I think. And he'd had a few drinks, George. Everything had gone well. And he started to sing Chattanooga Choo Choo. So this will remind me of that night.
Pardon me, boy, is that the Chattanooga Choo Choo?
Yes, yes, track 29.
Boy, you can give me a shine.
Can you afford to board Chattanooga Choo-Choo?
I got my fare
and just a trifle to spare.
You leave the Pennsylvania station about 3:45. Read a magazine and then you're in Baltimore.
Dinner in the diner, nothing good. and to have your ham and eggs in Carolina.
When you hear the whistle blowing 8 to the bar, then you know that Tennessee is not very far.
Shamalala calling, gotta keep it rolling.
Ooh, ooh, Chattanooga, there you are.
Glenn Miller and Chattanooga Choo Choo. So you're a lapsed Catholic who still pops into church sometimes?
Well, sometimes, yeah.
You're a working class boy who now lives in a middle class suburb, a bit like Brookside, I'm told, with a sort of green in the middle.
Yeah, it is a bit, yeah.
You're a reformed gambler who still goes to bingo on a Wednesday night.
Yeah, not every Wednesday night, but most, yeah.
With your mum?
Yeah.
And you still play cards on a Friday?
Yeah.
Do you have a conscience about any of these things, or are you more at ease with yourself these days?
I always used to have a conscience, but not about things like that. I think the thing to have a conscience about is if you have any kind of clout or influence, how do you use that clout and how do you use that influence and how do you spend your money? You know, I think they're the things to have a conscience about.
But do you feel you're using your clout? Do you feel you're having some influence?
I think recently I've been able to use it quite wisely. I've got a wee bit of clout now, post-cracker. Not post anything else, but post-cracker. And I've used it wisely. I've got a project that's extremely important and I've got that off the ground because of a wee bit of clout. You
What's
know?
That?
It's Hillsborough. It's a sort of investigation into what happened at Hillsborough.
You're going to like being on a desert island, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah. I can handle myself on my own.
What will you do there?
I think I'll just think about things and go for walks and maybe write, but I know I wouldn't have a pen and paper, but I'd find some means of writing. And I'd certainly think about stories.
Would you want to write if nobody was going to read it?
Oh, I think so, yeah. Just so maybe one day somebody would come across it. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that at all.
But say if they didn't, would you still want to do it? Is it an end in itself for you?
I think it probably is, yeah. There's a real big kick out of, you know, you're in your office at, say, 5:30 and you know you've written a couple of really good scenes. There's no better buzz. Well, the better buzzes, but it's a good buzz.
Last record.
Well, I have to pick this one, because this is always played a family night out, and I can't dance at all. And when this record comes on, I simply jump up and down. So every time this comes on, everybody goes Zebedee. And that's my cue to dance, because it's Come On, Ireland.
Dexys Midnight Runners and Come On, Eileen. So if you could only take one of those 8 records, Jimmy, which one would it be?
I think it would have to be the Nat King Cole, yeah.
When I Fall in Love.
Yeah.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about your book?
Well, I've made an awful lot of attempts to read James Joyce's Ulysses and never really succeeded. I've sort of jumped into it and jumped out of it again rather quickly. So I'd take that and try to read it properly.
And what about your luxury?
Well, I had to pick a thing that I always take along with me no matter where I go. And the thing I always take along with me is hemorrhoid ointment. So it would have to be there.
Yeah. Raw to the end. Jimmy McGuffin, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
It's a dream come true. Thank you.